This is a podcast from JUF.org.
David Broza is a living national treasure in Israel, possessed of a sandy yet powerful voice, hands that move like lightning across his guitar strings, and the ability to sing in three languages. He is a sought-after performer worldwide. Broza is also extremely prolific. His recent projects include a best-of compilation called The Setlist and East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, a documentary about his recording with Palestinian musicians, as well as some new singles. He will be in Chicago for his annual Not Exactly Christmas show this December. Shalom, David.
Hello.
Hello. You know, I'd like to
hola.
Be...
Mm-hmm.
Hola also, right. Shalom, hello, and hola, all of it. I need to begin by thanking you. My podcast with you was my very first, and since then, I've been able to do podcasts with many major Jewish musicians, including Matis Yahu, members of the Klezmatics, Peter Yarrow, the late Debbie Friedman, classical star Yefim Bronfman, and even Dave Brubeck, all because I was able to drop your name.
No, really?
So, yes.
Wow.
So, do you know when that was, when my first podcast with you was?
No.
I'll give you a clue. It was for your Masada concert with Jackson Brown and Dave and John Colvin.
Wow, 2007.
Yes. Right, so this is our 10th anniversary.
Wow, phenomenal. Amazing.
Yes.
So probably one of the first podcasts in history.
So since I haven't talked to you on a podcast for 10 years, catch us up. What have you been doing for the past 10 years?
No, you really mean that? I don't remember.
I don't remember. Okay, we can fast forward to now.
Well, no, I do remember. Of course, well, after the after that Masada show, which was epic for me, you know, having Jackson Brown, Sean Colvin, and then having it distributed by the Chicago WTTW PBS station, you know, they got it into basically every home in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a major, beautiful exposure. After that, I went on to do an album based on poetry by Towns Van Zandt, the great singer-songwriter who passed away in 1997, and had actually left me his unpublished poetry, which after many, many years, which was actually around 2008 and 2009, I got hold of them and started writing music to them and hence did an album with my music and his poetry, kind of homage to his poetry. That's Towns Van Zandt project. And after that, there was many other projects, including one of the most recent ones, which is the East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem album, which you just mentioned. And my main thing in as far as my career goes is being really touring and being, you know, anywhere between 150 to 200 shows a year. So I'm constantly on the road and constantly, also every show I bring on different artists or friends, unless I decide to do completely solo, just me and my guitar, which is also very special for me. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been doing for the past 10 years since I spoke to you last.
Okay. So I know it's not going to be for a couple months yet, but this is only June. But in December, are you already starting to plan for who's going to be here in December?
I'm not 100% close on that. I'm still calling a few musician friends who I'd like to see on the road with me, because I'm starting it out in California in the beginning of December, and I'll be going through California. Then I'll go to the East Coast, you know, do Boston, and then I'll do my annual New York Not Exactly Christmas show at the 92nd Street Y on December 24th, and then on the 28th, I'll be in Chicago. My musicians consist of Ali Parrish, who's an amazing kanun player, Palestinian. He's from Ramallah. He lives now in the United States and is one of the most magical, incredibly talented, and wonderful person
A kanun is somewhat like a dulcimer, I think, right? Is that right?
Yeah, the kanun is, it looks like the inside of a piano, has 78 strings.
Wow.
It sounds a little like but you play it, you pluck it, and he plays it with his fingers.
That's amazing. So it's almost like a harp.
It's like a laptop. It's not a laptop, it's like a flat one. It sits on your lap.
Right.
Or on a stand, like a
You play it like a harp, then.
Yeah, it's kind of, but lying down.
Right. Wow. I bet that's Beautiful.
A beautiful instrument. Kanun with a Q.
Oh, okay. So that's a new Scrabble word for anybody who plays that. So let's talk now about the set list collection. I have it here. This is not your first greatest hits collection. You had another one called It Will Be Better, I think, a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. It's 40 years already. And so just about every 10 years or so, there's reason to do an anthology or a compilation of my music to see how it progresses. Mm-hmm. My most recent, of course, is the set list.
Right. Can you tell us how you chose the songs for that collection?
Mm-hmm. You know, after every show, I we try to sell product. We sell CDs and DVDs, and now we sell vinyls again. Huh. And then people come and say, okay, so you sang this song and that song and this and the, so on which album? And then people say, well, I'm not going to buy 5 albums. Maybe I'll just buy 1 or 2. So I decided to compile many of the songs that I do in the show, not all of them, because I do a lot of music and the shows are long. But I chose 15 songs that I most probably would play at the show, and then that would give an answer to most of the public who wants to then acquire a CD and have some of the music that I just played. So they will have it either in its original recording in the studio or from some other live performance. It's an opportunity for them to walk away with a memorable track of songs.
So these are somewhat your most requested songs, in a way. These are the ones
I suppose, but also some of them are the biggest hits that I've had. Mm-hmm. I've had about 25 number one hits only in Israel, so it's hard to include all of them in an album. You normally make a box set or something like that.
Right, you need a double album.
I think for now, having a one CD, and when people don't really buy many, because unless in the periphery and people drive a lot, in which case they have a CD player in the car still, so...
I still collect CDs.
Huh?
I still collect CDs. My wife doesn't understand it, but I still do it.
I pop them in when I drive somewhere.
Right.
But I don't have a car now, because in Tel Aviv you don't need a car.
Oh.
And when I'm in New York, I don't need a car.
Right.
So when I drive with a friend, then I bring my CDs.
Otherwise he makes you sing, right?
That makes me sing, exactly.
So
it's a different experience.
Right. So you're also still doing your Masada concerts.
I still do it. It's been 93, so 25 years, almost, or 26 years, 24 years, it'll be 25 next.
Wow.
We do it in the summer, at the sunrise, it starts at 3 in the morning, the sun shines over the Jordan Valley, across from the Dead Sea, and the audience, along with me, is on the other side of Masada, and we see the sun come up. Show starts at 3 in the morning, and I play straight until 6:30 or 7, whatever, as long as it takes for the sun to rise, because it has to also rise above the clouds.
Right.
Because every night, because of the heat, there's a nebulous kind of a cloud-like, a blanket of clouds over the Dead Sea, and we're above the Dead Sea, and so we're watching the clouds from above, and as soon as the sun comes up, it all evaporates. And then you get to see the incredible view of seeing the Dead Sea right under your feet.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's magnificent.
And so...
Yeah, so I still do those shows.
So when do people have to start arriving for that?
We only open the doors at 2 o'clock. The show starts at 3.
Oh,
there's nothing there before that. There's no camping or restaurants or anything.
No, it's the top of a mountain, sure. Then they have
It's cool. It's been full every year for the past 24 years.
Do you have any special guests this year?
Not this year. This year I bring my Israeli band. I haven't really thought of it all clearly.
Okay.
So I have to put my mind to it in a couple of months.
Okay. One of the things I've been thinking about in terms of performers, especially in terms of a greatest hits collection like this, is the... What does it feel like to sing the same songs over and over again, sometimes for years, night after night? Do you get burnt out? Do you get bored? What do you have to do to keep feeling the emotion of the songs every night?
No, me personally, no, not at all. I love it. Okay. I mean, it's you know, I don't play the same show every night.
Right.
But of course, I like to entertain my audience, and so I will I will play songs that I'm hoping that they're expecting me to play and they want me to play, some of the biggest hits. But I will give it an interpretation of the day, mm-hmm. And that way it makes me really enjoy the playing and the performance. Every day brings new emotions and new thoughts, mm-hmm. and even though it may be a little and slight, mm-hmm. and you know, it gives complete new meaning every day. It's you know, it's like looking at the classical musicians who play, mm-hmm. you know, the same Mozart piece or Bach or Brahms, right. piece night after night after night, and giving it its interpretation of the day. It's an emotional thing.
Okay. You also don't only sing your own songs, you not only sing other people's songs, but other people's poems. How do you go about finding those poems, and how did that start?
How do I find them?
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, do people give you poetry books, or do you...
It's about really going to libraries and just reading and reading and reading, and then when I hear about a certain poetry book that has been established, you know, published, and I try to get a hold of it if it's been recommended, mm-hmm. and people sometimes send me poems, just because they know that I'm looking for things. Mm-hmm. So there's no real discipline about it, except to read a lot.
Right.
That's the main discipline.
Mm-hmm. Is poetry a major art form in Israel? Because as you probably have caught on, it's not very much in America anymore.
Yeah, in Israel and Spain, but for me, primarily Israel, that's what I know best. It's very common to turn poetry into song and into pop song. Hmm. So I've been doing that for 40 years throughout my career. The only time I didn't do it was when I wrote my own lyrics to my own songs, which is in a recent album called Third Language.
Right. And so do you also write in Spanish and in Hebrew and as well as in English?
Well, I certainly do, mm-hmm. but I don't, you know, I've only written one song or two songs that I published in Spanish. As in English, also, I've only written a few that I've recorded and published. Most of the time I work with poetry.
Okay. Do you adapt your playlist, your set list, as it were, to the country that you're in? Playing more English in America, more Hebrew in Israel, more Spanish in Spain, or say
sometimes,
you know, Argentina.
Sometimes, not necessarily, but I like to talk about them a little because there's always a circumstance to which I found these poems, and there's a story that might be of interest to the listener. Mm-hmm. And even though it's a poem in English, and I'm singing maybe in an English-speaking crowd, they might not quite follow because poetry at times can be twisted, and have a very imaginative and rich interpretation of something that is being told simply, or can be told simply.
Okay. So one of your other new albums is Andalusian Love Song.
The what?
The Andalusian Love Song album.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, can you tell the story behind that?
The Andalusian Love Song really is an album which reflects a project that I'm still performing with the Andalusian Orchestra of Jerusalem. When there, I met them over of Ashkelon, another town. Mm-hmm. It's a 35-piece orchestra, oh. of which 13 pieces, or rather musicians, come from Arab tradition, from North African tradition. So there's all the traditional instruments from North Africa, the kanun, like Ali Paris played, and the oud, which looks like a lute, but it's a string instrument, mm-hmm. and the darbuka, which is the drum, and the upright violin. It's very ethnic sounding. Uh-huh. And behind them, behind that first line of ethnic players, there's an orchestra of strings mainly, and they all play an accompaniment. Of course, the exotic musicians,
sure.
and the most interesting is the way that my music, being Western music, fits in into these arrangements. So we're starting with a song of mine, and then the arrangement brings in a very typical old Arab melody by a composer by the name of, let's say, Abdul Wahab.
Okay.
And it mixes with my music, so the Arab listener can hear something familiar, and then it breaks into my music, which is not familiar, but they seem to be coming from the same source.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a beautiful blend. And I've done about over 150 concerts with this this orchestra in Israel, and I plan to do many more. So it's such a beautiful experience for me.
Huh. Now, I mean, geographically speaking, people sort of associate, say, Arabic music with Israeli music, but Andalusia, isn't Andalusia in Spain?
It's not an Andalusian thing, interestingly enough. Andalusia really was North Africa, and when the Moors conquered South Spain back in the earlier centuries, around 1100 or 800, they came from Andalusia, which is north of Spain, north of Africa.
Right.
And when they conquered Granada and Cordoba and all those, they called that as part of, as if it was part of the part of the scenario of North Africa. They called that Andalusia, and Andalus, which really it's just the land of light, because the light in the southern parts of Spain and northern parts of Africa is so bright.
I mean, one of the things that struck me, I recently watched a concert that Lorena McKinnitt, who is a Celtic artist, did.
Which one?
Lorena McKinnitt did a concert in Alhambra. That was beautiful. And again, that's in Spain, but it has very strong Arabic influences, that architecture of that building.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fantastic.
So let's talk about your documentary, East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. That's a whole story all by itself. How did that start?
Sure. Well, you know, when I decided to do the album in East Jerusalem, the East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem album, I thought to myself that this has to be documented for whatever purpose. So I called in a producer who had been for a while trying to get me to work with him. He wanted to do some biography or something with me. And so I said, look, forget biography. Let's just do something that I'm doing right now.
Okay.
And we brought in three cameras, and we filmed these 8 days and eight nights in the studio and came up with a beautiful, I think, simple story of me being an Israeli artist trying to bring in Palestinian musicians along to play with complete trust and love in the studio, in the East Jerusalem studio, which is owned by an East Jerusalem band called the Sabrin.
So the band, the studio itself was in East Jerusalem?
Yes, it is. It still is. It's called the Sabrin Studios.
And so why did you only have 8 days?
Because at first I wanted to have 7 days, and everybody said it's going to be crazy to try and do an album in a week. I added a day.
8 days is a very Jewish time frame anyway.
I swear that's it.
Okay. Was there a message you were trying to send? Was it some sort of experiment? What was your motivation?
It wasn't an experiment. Not at all. You know, I'm still working in that studio. I've been in that studio for 19 years now. It's going to be 20 years in a year, so I'm very familiar with everybody there. I'm familiar with the studio. It's a very low-tech studio, but just wonderful environment. And it was really another project that my friend, my Palestinian friend, asked me if I would bring, and I thought, let's take the opportunity to make it into something bigger than just, you know, us recording or me recording. Let's try to tell a story that might maybe enlighten people and inspire others to not necessarily in Israel or Palestine, inspire others who come from troubled areas to try to engage in getting to know each other through music. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beautiful thing about music. It's really a bridge builder.
I agree. One of the bridges that you built was to Western music by bringing in Steve Earle. How did that happen? He's not the first person that would leap to mind when I would think of a Middle Eastern project. So how would he become involved in that?
Yeah, listen. You know, when I turned to Steve Earle, I knew him well, not well, not great like I do now. His opinions and his awareness and his really cause to raise issues of justice in society are so clear to me that I thought he would go immediately with a BDS attitude of boycotting and not wanting to come. And he surprised me when I called and asked him, would he produce an album with me in East Jerusalem? And he said, heck yeah. And he said, not only heck yeah, he said, just tell me when. And I said, okay, when is a good time for you?
Wow.
And I said, okay, let's find the right timing. And I said, okay, I don't know if I can afford you. He said, oh, forget about money. We'll figure it out. I'm coming.
Wow. That's
Yeah.
wonderful.
I mean, the film was made, and the film was produced and edited and started showing in festivals and so on. And I got a distribution deal with a great company called Film Movement, and basically they got Netflix interested in purchasing the film, which is now showing in 184 countries around the world. And the beautiful thing about Netflix for this particular film is because it exposes my Israeli friends, my Palestinian friends, making music together, and actually exposes us in our workplace, which is East Jerusalem, and also exposes the work that we do, that I do in the refugee camp, in the Shafat, the Palestinian refugee camp. There's these sort of stories. I don't go around making huge interviews about them because I think they are really part of the fiber of and the fabric of everybody around me's life. So I'm not selling the story as if, okay, this is sellable. This is really talking about the importance that music has and can have, besides being an entertainment and a form of art, that it can have in social aspects, in bringing change and creating change. And I'm talking about change as far as I'm concerned, because I don't want to be cynical. But the change I talk about is not a global change, and it's not a national change. It's really a change in small groups. It could be groups of two, three, four, five people. It could be groups of up to hundreds of people, and those hundreds of people can take it on and magnify that into much bigger things, which are beyond me. And these things are happening, not only with my music, and not only with the kind of project that I've exposed through some West Jerusalem, but of course, these things happen in life in general with artwork, and I'm very pleased to be able to say that Netflix liked this film and bought it because of its, I suppose, because of its touching narrative, and so it has helped a lot in as far as bringing it to people all over, from the Gulf states to the Saudis, Lebanese, and to the Americans, and to French. And now I was just visiting Argentina, and Argentinians in Buenos Aires and in Cordoba had watched it, and I met people all over who had something to say, or just been watching it because I was coming. They heard about it, they prepared themselves to watch it. So it's a great tool, and it's become a very effective story for future work that I do.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So it sounds like it's not only getting good reviews, it's actually having the impact you were hoping it would have.
Yes, no, it's absolutely that. It has, on a commercial level, it would be nice if it was commercially incredibly big. But I think the most important thing is that it actually sits there in people's iPhones and laptops and computers, and they can watch it at any given time on the in their hands, on their laps, or on the screens at home. It's invaluable, and it brings in people from a very unexpected spectrum of areas, and that's extremely inspiring and reassuring. So, I'm now working, hopefully, on my next film, which will be related to the big scope of music, but in a smaller way.
Okay. Who are some of the unexpected people who've reacted to the video, to the movie?
Well, like an archbishop from Argentina, from a small town in Argentina, an imam, a Muslim imam, very highly regarded rabbi. These are just religious people.
Wow.
Of course, when you talk about academia, so you meet professors and people who deal with intellectuality, and then you say, okay, that makes sense. But when you think about an imam, an archbishop, and a rabbi watching it, each in his own home, in their own time,
right,
you're thinking, okay,
right,
this obviously has a way of, the story has found a way to tell itself to the widest scope and array of people.
I watched the movie, and some of the performers in it are rappers. Was that a new experience for you, working with rap musicians?
I've always indulged in all kinds of experimentations, but working with G-Town was something that was actually introduced to me about 10 years ago, a little more, and we played on the walls outside of Bethlehem. And they were then in their teens still, 17, 18-year-olds. And we struck a friendship, and we continued jamming and playing around each other. And when I made this album, I had this lyric, P-E-A-C-E, that's the word I want to be, which I had written half in my sleep.
Right.
And Steve Earle caught up to it, and he said, this would actually be on the album.
Huh.
Let me write music to it. I said, okay, you're welcome to start playing with some music. I've got the perfect hip-hop group that would do it with me. As it is, I already had a hip-hop collaboration with Wycliffe Jean on East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, although I sing throughout the song, but I co-wrote that song, which is the title song of the album and the film.
Wow. Okay, that's, I think it's fun, to always be learning about new different kinds of music that are coming across. So let's flip that around and talk about some older music that's resurfaced. I was reading about your song, The Long Road. Can you tell the story? It's a little bit of a long story, but can you The Long Road.
The Merwin poem?
Oh, the long road, the one that was...
The long road. Yeah. No, because there's a W.H. Merwin poem, which is The Long Love.
Oh,
The Long Road. Long Road, that one is actually, to me, it's a triumphant kind of a story. In April of 1998, I'm recording it while being managed by Phil Brenner, who was Spyro Gyra's manager.
Oh, wow.
And he loves folk rock. He loves singer-songwriters. Huh. He wanted to play around a little bit and with some music for me, and he was managing me at the time, and he gave me a couple of songs. One is the Long Road, so I kind of learned it and gave it my own interpretation to some degree, and then he thought it should be a duet. And we recorded it, and it was going to be one of the singles for my up-and-coming album, which was going to be basically a compilation of previous recordings plus this and Suavecito, which is another track that I did a cover for. And unfortunately, about a month or 2 months after I recorded it, before we were releasing it, I had a near-fatal accident. And,
oh, my God.
I ended up being paralyzed in my arms. And I was told I'll never play again.
Oh, my God.
And so that put an end to my career plan at the time.
Oh, my God. And, was it a car accident? What happened?
And we kind of shelved the album.
Uh-huh.
So this was many years ago. It's 1998, so almost 20 years ago. And then this past year, when I was about to start working and promoting my show in London at Union Chapel, I was thinking, how can we make this an interesting release? For the album, for the show, and suddenly The Long Road came into the picture. So we decided to release Long Road, and why not, and then decided to include that in the new album going to come out, which I talked about earlier, about a compilation that will actually celebrate songs that I sing normally live in shows.
That's an amazing story. Can you tell me a little bit more about the accident? Was it a car accident? What happened?
Well, I was driving back from a late night show in the desert in Israel, and my driver, I always have a driver when I work. My driver fell asleep at the wheel at 90 miles an hour and drove us into some light or lights, you know, traffic lights on the highway, which, I mean, nobody was killed, and I was the most severely injured, but it was a near fatal accident, and I was, as a result, I was paralyzed for 1 year in my arms, and even though they thought I would never perhaps play again as a possibility, the miracles do happen, and so I was,
it must have been.
I was saved that agony.
Wow. Yeah, I don't need you to relive it for me. I was just curious. You know, it's interesting to me because a lot of great guitarists, unfortunately, do go through these things. Steve Miller had an accident. Bob Dylan had an accident where they do feel that that's going to be the end of it. So it's remarkable that so many times that's happened, but then in the end, everyone is fine. At least physically.
Well, you know, we're resilient as people, mm-hmm. you know, and you see things which are terrible, which people get through and continue with their lives. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are moments where you could be exasperated and very, very much depressed.
So let's talk about the actual new track. Now, it sounds like The Long Road is both new and old, whereas The Juggler is a new track altogether.
Ah. That's a cool song.
Okay.
Interesting that you actually are so updated. yeah, well, The Juggler is actually part of a project, which is not my project.
Oh.
A project that was made in Israel. And it was trying to get people who are related to people who were hurt by sabotage, by terror, or in wars. Mm-hmm. And it's every year, like here in the States, we have a Memorial Day. For the fallen, and
right.
I was asked if I would participate in one in a very special way. They wanted me to select a story, mm-hmm. a tragic story of one person or a family, mm-hmm. and I should read their tragedies and then see what if I can write a song about it, which will be released around Memorial Day, which is you know, just the end of April, beginning of May. So I read through a bunch of them, and I picked one who was the brother of a slain soldier who was in reserve and mm-hmm. serving in the Gaza Strip and was picked up by Hamas terrorists who were dressed as religious Jews, and he, of course, innocently thought he was getting a ride. He got on their car and was kidnapped and murdered.
Oh, my God.
The family, needless to say, is very, very devastated,
sure.
And the brother, his brother, instead of looking for vengeance, went the other way and dedicated his life to improving the Israeli-Palestinian relations. And the first thing he did was he joined the Bereaved Parents Circle, which is an incredible organization of bereaved parents and members of families from the Israeli side and Palestinian side who've lost loved ones.
Wow.
And they together try to find the middle road where they can live and build a future and live in peace. So, he, on top of that, he started an organization that delivers by car sick, very, very terminally and just very sick people from Gaza and from the West Bank and Palestinians and brings them to Israeli hospitals to get treated and then drives them back home. He delivers and basically transports 100 patients a day for the past 10 years, 365 days a year. So it's a remarkable project. And so I wrote this song with a partner, Tzuya Lav, who's a woman who writes beautiful poetry. Mm-hmm. And basically I told her when I told her what the story is all about, before sending her the manuscript of our conversation,
right.
I told her that to me, it felt as, I mean, when I asked the guy, what does he do for a living? He said he was a juggler.
Yeah.
I said, that makes perfect sense.
Right.
Sounds like you're juggling throughout your life where
right.
the balls maybe represent your soul and you don't let them fall because if
right.
they fell, your whole spirit would be down. So it keeps you kicking up the spirit by juggling. And so we called it the juggler.
Wow. That's a remarkable story also. I mean, it just sounds like you you find these stories. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, he's a great guy.
Let me get to a little bit more of a global kind of thing. You've traveled all over the world. What is it about Israel that you really wish, if you just had like a soapbox that could just talk to the West or to Americans specific and say, here's what you don't understand about Israel. Let me break it down for you. Let me explain it to you. What would you say?
Well,
not to put you on the spot.
Politics aside, it's an incredible miracle. I would say to anybody who doesn't understand, to try to sit in front of his desk, clear up the desk, take a blank paper, and just write out a plan on how to build a country. And I want to see how he does it without making any mistakes. Now, there is no excuses for mistakes, and there's no excuses for mishandling of situations. But you know, on the human level, if you know that there are mistakes, you're gonna have to try and correct them. So I've been very happily and proudly as an Israeli, working and indulging in trying to correct issues that deal with social issues, such as Israeli-Palestinian and not just political issues. And of course, I work with the handicapped. We have a club with 2,500 kids in wheelchairs that basically my father started and put me on it when I was 7 years old. So now at 61, you know, I've been working there almost my entire life. And the one thing I think people are not aware of, the fact is that it's very young and full of vitality, unlike any place else that you will find on Earth. Maybe it's because it is in a war zone. Maybe because it's very intensely small and surrounded by enemy countries. I don't know what it is, but there's something, there's a certain camaraderie and a flavor for life, which is really unique to any Western civilization that exists in Israel, unlike any other place. All I could say is, you know, try to piece together the fresh breeze coming in from the sea at sunset, when you can finally let the sun go down and walk back from the beach and stop at never-closing little bars, have a chilled drink, and then walk down the street and meet some nice, beautiful-looking people and continue hanging on and hanging out from one place to another for the rest of the night until you put your head down and wake up on the next day and start all over again on the beach. That alone to me is an ingredient that I don't think... I mean, there's many places you could do that in the Bahamas, you can do it in Mexico, you could do it, no end. But the way it happens in Israel, it has a unique flavor to it. And I wouldn't want to sell too much in Israel. It should remain our favorite secret, but if anybody's looking for secretive places... That's the way
to go. Well, that is a wonderful commercial for Israel, and I've been there several times.
I'm trying to tell you, this is my commercial, but
no, I've been there several times. I love it. I have family there. I took my wife there for our honeymoon, and I loved it. In fact, I'm going back later this year for a bar mitzvah in my family.
Oh wow!
So this will be my fourth trip. October, we're going for a Sukkot.
Okay, well, I hope
that
then you can come and see a show.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll find out where you're playing. That would be
a thing. Yeah, look it up, and if you want to come, I'll send you, I think I can text you my email or whatever, and let me know.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for calling and for calling back. And
thank you.
Well, good luck to you with everything you're doing, and I hope to see you soon.
This has been a podcast from the Jewish United Fund, Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago. For more information, visit juf.org.